Thanks for joining us. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Diane hopes to be back on the air next week. Under pressure from Iran's supreme leader, members of the Iranian parliament approve 18 of President Ahmadinejad's 21 hardline cabinet nominees. Several lawmakers say nearly half would have been rejected without the supreme leader's intervention. A NATO airstrike in northern Afghanistan kills up to 90 people. The once-calm region has come under control of militants. The United States cuts off $30 million in aid to Honduras. Joining me for the Friday News Roundup of International News, Michael Hirsch of Newsweek, Tom Gelton of NPR, and Kevin Sullivan of The Washington Post. Welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
Hi, Susan. Hi,
thank you.
We're going to invite our listeners to join our conversation later in this hour. You can call our toll-free number, 1-800-433-8850, or you can always send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Well, let's start, as we have many times in recent weeks on the News Roundup, with the situation in Afghanistan. Michael Hirsch, what's the latest on the presidential election results?
Well, amid charges of voter fraud, it appears that Hamid Karzai, who has been president since he was partially installed, partially elected during the Bush administration, is likely to continue to be the president, which has disappointed a lot of people because there's a sense that he simply has not gotten the control over things. There's questions of corruption surrounding his family. And his closest opponent, Abdullah Abdullah, who was a former defense minister, is, you know, continuing to challenge the results.
Well, they continue to challenge the results. And, in fact, there are very credible accusations of enormous fraud in the election, Tom.
Right, Susan. And, in fact, I think what's really been disappointing about the outcome of the election in Afghanistan is not simply that Karzai won, because I think that, you know, there are a lot of problems with Karzai, but that the results are so questionable, which means that the Afghan population is not likely to look at any government that comes out of this election as having the kind of legitimacy it would need in order to really have public support. And public support is so important in that country to sort of give some stability to the situation, regardless of who's the president. If the people don't believe in their government, that really sets the stage for further gains by the insurgency. I think that's the really disappointing part about this, that so many questions have been raised about the legitimacy of the process.
Meanwhile, Kevin, we saw the assassination of the deputy intelligence chief in Afghanistan. Now, this is just one man. How significant is his loss?
It's significant that they were able to get to him. I mean, what we've seen in the last few weeks is that the Taliban really are emerging as a much better fighting force than they've ever been. And for them to be able to get to him gets to the same question of the legitimacy and the security of this government. And in addition to the way the Afghan people feel about their government, the way that President Obama and the United States look at the Afghan government is incredibly important. Support for this whole effort is wobbling here in the United States, and the president is trying to make the case, look, this is a friend in need. This is an important place in the world. This is a government we can do business with. And with everything that we've been hearing recently, that really brings it into question.
We hear a lot of Americans see a definite erosion in support for the war in Afghanistan among Americans, and yet the Defense Secretary, Robert Gates, said yesterday or suggested that he would be open to sending more U.S. troops there. Michael, what's likely to be ahead?
Well, this is all coming under the rubric of Vietnam-like questions that are being asked about our effort in this country, the lack of a clear strategy, exit strategy, or even a strategy going forward for victory. That's why you're hearing both here politically on the left and the right, and even some within the military services saying, you know, if we can't come up with a clear strategy, perhaps we should get out. And Gates was not himself very clear on that. Remember, this has been a number of months we've been waiting to hear what the U.S. strategy was. There was a sense last year when David Petraeus became CENTCOM commander that we would hear more about it, that we might hear of some version, for example, of the surge strategy that was used in Iraq in combination with counterinsurgency tactics. And yet, you know, General McChrystal the commander on the ground now has yet to come through with it with a clear strategic vision.
Well, the lead story in this morning's New York Times is Obama advisors are split on side of Afghan force. And we read in the story that Vice President Biden, among others, is very concerned about the possibility of sending more troops. You have Hillary Clinton, the Secretary of State, apparently speaking in support of the idea. What do you hear, Tom?
Well, Susan, I think one of the things that's interesting with regard to that debate is that Robert Gates himself, the defense secretary, has articulated the concern of those who are worried about sending more troops. And the day before yesterday, what he said was that he was concerned about the footprint that increased American troops would have in Afghanistan, and whether the sort of the presence of Americans would itself become a political problem and that Afghans would resent it. Now, again, yesterday he then came around and said that he'd been reassured by what General McChrystal told him about the footprint, and he said that the effects could be mitigated. But he had raised that issue that went to the heart of the concerns of those people inside the administration that this may not be such a great idea.
What are the stakes here, Kevin Sullivan, for President Obama, who during the campaign last year talked about Afghanistan as the right war in contrast to Iraq as being not the right war?
Well, this is where he has placed all of his bets in foreign policy at the moment. If this fails, it's a massive loss for him. I think the political squabble that we're seeing going on now, you have to take a step back and see this in historical terms. The political fight in 2009 has to be seen in terms of what happened to the British in Afghanistan, what happened to the Soviets in Afghanistan. This was Secretary Gates' concern. He was saying in the past, the Soviets had 150,000 troops, I think, in there at the height of their occupation. And this is what really turned the Afghans against them. This is what really mobilized them.
And how many U.S. troops are there now?
I think it's about 68,000.
By the end of the year, I think we'll be at 68,000.
That includes some that are on their way.
That's the plan. And I think, there's a general sense that under traditional strategies, that's not nearly enough for a country this size.
And so how many more troops might be on their way, Tom?
Well, there's talk of as many as 30 or 40,000 more troops. I think that's... Going back to Kevin's point, I think that the real question here is one of time, not just numbers of troops, but how soon can this situation begin to look more promising. I think that President Obama has a very limited window here to maintain support for increasing troop numbers. And if a year from now things do not look any better, it's a very different situation. He may be able to get these tens of thousands of additional troops in the short run, but they wouldn't have a lot of time to prove their effectiveness.
And the bigger question really is, again, a strategy. And it's not just Afghanistan. One of the reasons you're seeing a divide among Obama's advisors and within the military is because the question is, what should the focus be? Many people say that Pakistan needs to be the focus, both the stability of that nuclear-armed country and the question of whether, in fact, most of the al-Qaeda leaders that are still alive are harbored in that country.
Another question is, what is victory for the United States in Afghanistan? I think a lot of Americans don't think they have an answer to that question.
Chuck Hagel wrote in the Post yesterday, how do you define victory there? I think one of the things that the critics of this whole effort have been saying is that the administration needs to make it clear whether they see this as a short-term counterterrorism program that's going to last maybe 5 or 10 years, or whether we're really in this for 20, 30, 40 years to stabilize something.
There's really no history for the United States having a sustained military presence in another country. Well, I guess you could look at something like Western Europe, post-World War II, but in terms of this kind of military action, I can't think of a precedent for that. North Korea, the Korea Peninsula, maybe?
Certainly peaceful occupation, yes, but not an ongoing fight against a vibrant insurgency. And I think the political problem that Obama has going forward is, we're seeing the first inklings of that, and again, not to overdo the Vietnam analogy, but one has to think of that, is that both on the left and the right, you have Democratic senators like Russ Feingold, you have those on the right like George Will, who wrote in a column the other day that, we ought to get out. And to the extent that grows, he's going to have a huge political headache.
Let's talk about Iran. The parliament there backed Ahmadinejad's cabinet choices. Considered a big victory that they did that, Tom. Why?
Well, because, there had been really sort of two two debates going on, or two political conflicts underway in Iran. Obviously, the one between the reformers who believe the presidential election was stolen from them. But then even within the conservative camp, President Ahmadinejad had a problem with his own fellow conservatives, some of whom saw him as putting a lot of cronies in his government. The word was tryouts, people that were in their positions by virtue of loyalty to him rather than their competence. And so there was an expectation, perhaps, that there was going to be some resistance. The parliament is controlled by conservatives, so there wasn't going to be a lot of debate along the reform versus hardline lines. But there was expected to be a debate within the conservative camp itself. That seems to have dissipated. And for the moment, it seems the supreme leader, Khamenei, has rallied all the conservatives around, at least for the moment, Ahmadinejad. So you're right, 18 out of 21, there was an expectation that there would be more resistance to his nominees.
One of these cabinet members is the suspected mastermind in the bombing of an Argentine Jewish center that killed 85 people, and yet now he's in the Iranian cabinet.
Right, and I don't think anyone there sees that as particularly unusual. I think, you know, there were great cries of support when he won the vote. This has made the United States and Israel and all kinds of other people a little bit insane, but there, I think it was just seen as the equivalent of someone on the, you know, the relatively far right being elected. It wasn't seen as that unusual.
And in fact, I mean, another suspect in that bombing was one of the other presidential candidates, General Mohsen Rezai, who was also head of the Revolutionary Guard. And so, you know, again, you have something that's sort of imbued in the Islamic revolutionary culture.
Except now you have a member of the Iranian government, yes, who has an Interpol warrant for his arrest.
And no diplomatic immunity.
No diplomatic immunity at all.
He also named the first woman minister since the 1979 Islamic Revolution. We're going to take a very short break, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation about the international news of the week. Our phone lines are open. You can call us at 1-800-433-8850 or send us an email at drshow@wamu.org. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. And I'm joined in the studio by Tom Gelton, correspondent for NPR. He's the author of Bacardi and the Long Fight for Cuba, the biography of a cause. And Kevin Sullivan, who joins us for the first time on the News Roundup. Welcome, Kevin.
Thank you very much.
He is the deputy foreign editor for The Washington Post. He is the co-author of The Prison Angel. And Michael Hirsch, senior editor at Newsweek magazine. He has a book, too, At War With Ourselves, Why America is Squandering Its Chance to Build a Better World. Well, news out of North Korea today. North Korea announced that its process of enriching uranium is nearly complete, which gives it a second way to make nuclear bombs. Is this just a negotiating tactic, Michael Hirsch, or should we take this very seriously?
Well, I think both things are true. I mean, I think it is, as it has always been with the North Koreans, a form of international blackmail, in effect, to ratchet up its nuclear program and then look to cut a deal down the line. It's, you know, in the context of what's happened, which is another recent nuclear test, the complete cessation of any talks over the larger issues of Iran's nuclear program or its proliferation, it's particularly alarming because it does seem as if, whereas only less than a year ago, the United States was close to a deal, it seemed, with North Korea to dismantle its nuclear program. It's now, back doing it full force.
So what do we do, Tom?
Well, you know, what makes this particularly challenging, Susan, is that lately North Korea has been much more conciliatory toward the United States and towards the West, the rest of the world in general. A number of moves that seemed clearly designed to kind of lower the temperature in North Korea's relations with its allies. And then it responds by this. I think that what it appears is that North Korea is once again, sort of testing the waters to see how far it can go with this sort of mixture of overtures and defiance. An interesting comment from the North Koreans this morning, we are prepared for both dialogue and sanctions. You know, they're actually playing this game pretty cleverly, and I think it is going to be very difficult for the United States and for other countries to figure out how exactly to deal with North Korea. We just had President Clinton there not very long ago, and Kim, the North Korean leader, beaming from ear to ear. I mean, do we sort of go with the friendly overtures, or do we stand up against this kind of defiance?
This has always been the beauty of North Korea. They're a 120-pound fighter and a heavyweight bout. You know, all they can do is keep their opponent off balance, and they do it incredibly well. You never know what's coming next. Ultimately, what they want is survival of the regime, and they are very clever about doing everything they can to prolong the life of their leaders.
I mean, it was interesting, the Clinton visit during the Clinton administration, really the very last months of the Clinton administration, Kim Jong-il was bargaining hard to have President Clinton visit before he left office. And in fact, they were pretty close to a deal to stop the production of their intercontinental missiles. And that failed. And then, you know, from what we've learned about this most recent Clinton visit to rescue the journalists, this is what Kim wanted. Apparently, they did have a talk, you know, over some of the larger issues. So it's clear that the door is at least partly open by the North Koreans. You know, show us some respect and international aid, which is always what they're bargaining for, and we would be willing to deal once again.
It's striking how little we really know what's going on in North Korea. You know, we've had a lot of reports that Kim Jong-il is in quite failing health, and yet John Podesta, who went with President Clinton, when he went to North Korea recently, said that he seemed fully engaged, didn't seem to be the very frail figure we thought he might be.
Well, that's right. He seems to have made some kind of recovery. You know, there's always been a lot of speculation about whether the pictures that we see of him are, in fact, pictures of a body double. But now we've had President Clinton himself there meeting with him in person, so we can put that to rest. But on the other hand, I think you have to look back at all the efforts that Kim Jong-il did to promote his son to be clearly the successor. Would he be doing that if he were confident of living another 10 or 20 years? And I think that a lot of the moves that North Korea has made in the last couple months must be seen in that context of Kim trying to sort of set everything in place for his son to take over. So clearly, there is some issue about how long he will be around.
Yeah, but it's still a little bit of a diplomatic fool's game to depend on a change of regime. I mean, Hillary Clinton, on her very first trip abroad earlier in the year, she made some controversial comments to the effect that Kim might not be around for very long. Well, he might be around for years, you know. And the same thing applies to the Iranian regime and the question of what happened after the protests against the election results. I mean, I think in the end, you're probably going to have to deal with these regimes as distasteful as they are.
A better analogy may be, as you and I know from our time in Cuba, Tom, a better analogy is Castro. I mean, I'm sure the Washington Post has had an obituary ready to go for him since about 1969.
Has to have a series of American presidents.
Yes, exactly.
Yes.
Exactly. Right. Exactly.
Well, let's go to the phones and let our listeners join our conversation. You can call us at 1-800-433-8850. We'll go first to Leslie, calling us from Farmerville, Arkansas. Hi, Leslie.
Hey, how are y'all this morning?
Good.
Good. I've got three quick things here. On the Afghanistan thing, you know, Karzai was /installed/elected, whatever. You know, we have put people in governments in other countries for a long time now, which I think is wrong. We need to stop that. We're talking about the legitimacy of a government we should be trading with these people if they have anything to trade. But we shouldn't be up in their government. And the fact that we are putting people in offices in other governments or helping elections in other governments is not the way to grow our democracy by example. So we have to ask about the legitimacy of our own government, if you ask me, under those circumstances. On North Korea, I think Barack Obama is doing a fine job. I think it's a very difficult thing, and I think that he did an about-face from President Bush, and I think he did a really good thing.
All right, Leslie, thanks so much for your call. Let's talk about Leslie's comments on Afghanistan and Karzai. Did we install him? Is he our guy?
He is our guy. We didn't precisely install him, but I think she raises a very good point. We shouldn't be installing leaders in other countries, but I think you have to remember that this was triage. This was emergency room treatment after September 11th, and we were in there doing taking extraordinary steps in extraordinary times. And, you know, a lot of things that happened in those days right after 9/11 are being reconsidered now.
Let's be absolutely clear about what happened. It was an international effort. The United Nations went in there and itself organized the Loya Jirga, which was the national conference of leaders who in turn anointed Karzai. So yes, he was put up. He was certainly the favorite U.S. candidate, but this was broadly legitimized at the time. So I don't think we should rewrite history and assume that this was simply a U.S. coup.
And also at the time, he was head and shoulders above anybody else we might have considered for that job.
You know, Susan, interesting, as you said, we should be trading with Afghanistan more. We are trading with Afghanistan. We're buying a lot of heroin from Afghanistan, and that's precisely the problem, and that's the problem with Karzai, is he's so linked to this. I'm sure that the United States at this point would wish that they had a far less corrupt government to deal with there.
But the problem is that there still aren't any other, you know, clear candidates who could govern. I mean, Abdullah, his closest opponent, is, by many accounts, a very solid guy, very intelligent guy. I've met him and interviewed him myself. But even though he is of mixed ancestry, he's seen as a Tajik by many Afghans. And that's just political death in terms of governing, because 40% of the country is still Pashtun. And they would be very unlikely to recognize a Tajik leader, which would mean probably more sympathy and support for the Taliban than you already have.
You know, we talked earlier in this hour about some of the reasons to leave or to pull down the U.S. presence in Afghanistan, including the history of empires coming to bad ends there. What is the rationale for staying there, for even increasing the U.S. presence?
One of the most compelling ones that they make all the time is Pakistan. Mm-hmm. Just across the mountains, just across the border, we have a country that's of tremendous vital interest to us. It's nuclear armed. It's increasingly unstable, and the Taliban on those side of the mountains is making an increasing run at that government. And stability in Afghanistan equates to more stability in Pakistan, according to the people who push that.
You know, Susan, in fact, you mentioned earlier Vice President Biden being one of those who's critical of the idea of building up forces in Afghanistan. But his whole idea is that it's not that he downplays the importance of Pakistan. It's the opposite, that he thinks Pakistan is so important that we should focus more on Pakistan than Afghanistan. So what we see here is just a difference of opinion about how to deal with Pakistan. I mean, because there is, Kevin is absolutely right, probably the best argument for stabilizing Afghanistan is that it's necessary in order to keep control of the situation in Pakistan.
And in fact, these situations are so intertwined that the Obama administration named a special ambassador to deal with both of them together, Richard Holbrooke. What do we hear from him, Michael Hirsch? What is he doing on this combination of problems in Afghanistan and Pakistan?
Well, he's fully engaged in the debate over troop levels and the strategy, but what he's been doing mainly, as far as I know, for the last several months is making repeated trips mostly to Pakistan, also dealing with the Indians. You have a problem with the Pakistani military and intelligence, where for most of that country's history, they've been oriented toward their great strategic rival and their perceived enemy, India. And he's been trying to get them to reorient toward taking on the terrorists, the Taliban, in their own backyard. There's been some success at that. He's also helped with quelling some of the political divisions there between the current president, who has been Azir Bhutto's widower, and his leading rival. And he's had some success at that as well.
The New York Times story this morning puts him on the side of advocating more troops going to Afghanistan. Well, let's talk to Michael. He's calling us from Norfolk, Virginia. Michael, you're on the air.
Thank you. I just have a question. This about North Korea. We've had this situation since the Clinton years. They threaten with their little nuclear, whatevers, and we say, okay, just stand that down, and we'll give you what you want, and we have. And then during the Bush years, again, it was the same deal, and it's the same game over and over and over again. A few years ago, we invaded Iraq looking for weapons of mass destruction that North Korea actually owns. And here we are again. We're playing this game. Oh, you know, they blew something up. I don't know what it was. You know, question how successful it was just a few months back. So here we are again playing this game. North Korea's enriching uranium, and we're putting up with it. I don't think they're playing a clever game. I think we're the ones that are being played.
Well, you know, Michael, what about Michael's point? Are we just being played, and should we just say we're not going to do that anymore, disengage?
Well, it's the fool me once school of diplomacy, right? And I think there are people who say, how many times do we have to see this behavior repeated before we'll catch on that we really need to just get tough with these people?
Well, but what's our option?
That's
I guess that's the question.
Yeah. I mean, what are you going to do? Are you going to try to take them out militarily when you have a million North Korean soldiers on the border with South Korea? You can't do that. Are you going to try and do beefed up sanctions without the support of North Korea's most important supplier, China? I mean, the options are really bad, bad, bad.
And indeed, that, you know, those options were considered. They were considered by the Clinton administration before its 1994 framework agreement, which was seen, you know, by the right as one in a series of events, you know, being fooled by the North Koreans. But there aren't good options because most of the military scenarios that I've heard about inevitably come up with huge numbers of civilian dead as well as, remember, there are still a large number of U.S. Troops there, about 28,000. And so, you've got a very dire situation.
I think one thing that gets lost in this debate is how close Seoul is to that border. It's about 30 miles, and North Korea has what is often described as the greatest array of conventional artillery in the history of the planet. Within striking distance of Seoul, and an awful lot of people would die.
And you know, and let's keep in mind the context here. I mean, this is a lone country, which, yes, is a danger, particularly to proliferation, but is surrounded by still thriving countries, most of which are U.S. allies or friends. So, you know, it's not some situations just have to be kept a lid on, and that's all you can do about them.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're taking your calls and reading your emails. You can send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Well, two of our panelists have actually lived and worked in Japan covering the situation there. Now we see this historic election that has ousted the Liberal Democratic Party after a half century of almost continuous rule. Kevin Sullivan, you've worked there. How does this affect Japan's relationship with the United States? Does it?
It will, in I think fairly cosmetic ways. I think a lot of the things that we're seeing out of the new prime minister are for domestic consumption. People say things during political campaigns that ultimately don't translate into
What did he say during the campaign that might cause concern?
He said that Japan had suffered from U.S.-backed globalization. He said that Japan should stand on its own 2 feet more and not be dependent on the United States, which they have been and always have been. And as far as I can remember, Japanese politicians have always said this because it plays very well. But I hate to be the grump here, but I think what we ought to be looking at is the over-under on when the LDP comes back.
You think that they will be back?
I do.
Because?
Because they have an awfully long and very strong legacy grip on that country that people get angry, they do things, but they will probably get tired of this government too.
Well, if they've got such a grip on things, why did they lose in this big landslide, Michael?
Well, because Japan has been in a long period of slow growth, and obviously they've also been hit by the global downturn. And I think, after 50 years or so, there was naturally, even for the Japanese, who are glacially slow in changing things, some sense of discontent. But, I mean, I agree with Kevin that this is not likely to mean any kind of a change, certainly not in the military relationship with the U.S. In fact, Hatoyama, the new incoming prime minister, said that just the other day. But, there is a certain legitimate gripe here about what he called market fundamentalism and what that did to Japan and the so-called Japan model. I mean, this is an issue going back to the early 90s. And so that, as Kevin said, that did resonate with a lot of the public.
It's not as if the Democratic Party has any track record or even really any proven ideological platform on which to stand. I mean, this was a referendum on the LDP, and the Democratic Party in Japan, it's not like it has a lot of think tanks behind it generating new ideas. It's kind of an empty slate.
We cover the first ladies here in the United States pretty closely, and the wife of the prime minister elect seems pretty colorful. She says that she's traveled to outer space while her body was sleeping, and her spirit flew on a triangular shaped UFO to Venus. Is this going to have any effect on how this new Japanese government does?
No, but it's probably going to have some effect on how Michelle Obama prepares for her first trip to Japan. This is going to be an interesting conversation. I think what the prime minister matters, not his wife, but she is quite a colorful character.
Oh, remember that Nancy Reagan used to get advice from Eleanor Roosevelt, right?
Well, but she didn't say she went on a UFO to Venus. And,
Japanese PM thought it. Yeah. She's getting it in person.
What do we know about the new prime minister-elect, Michael?
Well, he has a long pedigree in his party. I believe it was his grandfather who founded it in the immediate post-war period. And then, of course, you know, it was not running things. It was kind of the odd man out in the political power structure, which was dominated by the LDP. And briefly, there was a socialist prime minister. So you see that a lot in Japan. I mean, so many of those who became prime minister or reached senior levels or leadership positions in the various parties, you often find are the sign of some political family and been around for several generations occupying the same seat.
Also educated at Stanford University. Well, we're going to take another short break. When we come back, we'll go straight to the phones, 1-800-433-8850, and read some of your emails. You can send us an email at drshow@wamu.org. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Frederica and Howard Stevenson, helping low-income students access education through the Summer Search Foundation at summersearch.org. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, our Animal Week series concludes with animal actors. Animal trainer Bill Berlone tells us about rescue dogs who barked big on Broadway. We find out where showbiz and circus primates go when they retire, and we hear from the creator of Triumph the Insult Comic Dog. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. We're joined for the international hour of our Friday News Roundup with Tom Gelton from NPR, Kevin Sullivan of The Washington Post, Michael Hirsch of Newsweek. Let's go to Grand Rapids, Michigan, and talk to Jose. Jose, thank you for giving us a call.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
I'm trying to follow in a positive way, given the benefit of the doubt, to the administration about their policy to Central America, but it's kind of puzzling. Here we have a country that had no elections for 50 years, and the U.S. is trying to normalize relations with it. The president has never been elected, yet it's recognized by the U.S. And then we have in Honduras a constitutional crisis of a president that was removed by constitutional means, although perhaps in a rough way and mishandled, but all within the parameters of their constitution, by the Supreme Court, a national legislature, member of his own party. And the U.S. is cutting basically all, you know, help to that country, imposing its will on it. And it's puzzling. I have no idea what this is about.
And, Jose, are you from Central America yourself?
No, I was a monitor for Caribbean and Latin American affairs at the Carter Center during graduate school for 3 years. I've been doing this for 30 years. And I'm puzzled that the developments in Central America coming out of the civil wars of the 80s were in countries where successfully the left and the right have moved towards constitutional governments, like in El Salvador, Nicaragua, Honduras itself. And now we have a president there who was trying to get his country to move into the circle of Chavez, who clearly has a different agenda than democratization for Latin America. And we have a White House that seems not to understand the new paradigms and the new things that are developing in Latin America, and it's operating out of old 20-30-year-old views on that region.
All right, Jose, thank you so much for your call. Tom?
I think Jose was referring in the beginning of his comments to Cuba. And, you know, it is true that one of the ironies of this, particularly if you cover the policy debate here in Washington, some of the groups that are pushing the hardest to impose trade sanctions, really severe trade sanctions on Honduras, are the very same groups that are pushing to remove trade sanctions on Cuba, saying in the case of Cuba, they're saying engagement doesn't, we need to have a policy of engagement. Sanctions don't work. With respect to Honduras, they're saying we need sanctions. We shouldn't be engaged. You know, there does.
So why the inconsistency?
Well, one is a, you know, it seems to be almost an ideological thing that one is a, you know, I mean, Micheletti is a right-wing guy. Zelaya, Micheletti, the current president, the one who kicked out Zelaya, Zelaya was a left-wing president. There seems to be sort of a ideological aspect to it. However, I would say I have a lot more sympathy for the administration on this position than Jose does, because in spite of what Jose just said, there is a consensus. In fact, I would beyond consensus, unanimity across Latin America, that this situation in Honduras should not be tolerated. If the United States were to support Micheletti, the current de facto president, in his position, and oppose Zelaya in his efforts to return to power, it would be at odds with basically all of Latin America. And this would actually reflect, I think, back on the days when the United States and Latin America were on different pages. So I sympathize with the Obama administration on this issue, in spite of what appears to be a double standard.
Now, we saw Secretary of State Hillary Clinton yesterday announce that the U.S. is cutting off about $30 million in aid to put pressure on the government. This has to be a tough call also, because this is a tiny, impoverished country. You know, you don't want to hurt the people in an effort to squeeze the government.
Right, and I think Tom's right. They are walking a very careful line down the middle. I think what Jose gave us was a very eloquent, articulate argument for one side of this debate. The other side is that soldiers burst into the president's bedroom in the middle of the night and, with guns drawn, forced him on a plane to leave the country. That, by most definitions, kind of meets the standard of coup. Now, the United States can't quite bring themselves to say that because there are, as Jose points out, rightly complicating factors here. But this is a real pickle for the administration, and they've chosen kind of a very delicate middle line.
Michael?
Yeah, I mean, and to show how this isn't like the 70s and 80s, I mean, you didn't just have a straightforward coup with a guy in epaulets taking over. You have this proclamation of a return to constitutionality. I mean, my God, you even had the interior minister quoting JFK about paying any price and bearing any burden for liberty. Irony of ironies. And what the U.S. is trying to do here with this move on the foreign aid is simply to get the government to back this plan that Oscar Arias of Costa Rica mediated, which was to have Zelaya come and serve out his term. In other words, it's just sort of a compromise. The government is resisting that, and so this is what the pressure tactic is about. And I completely agree with what both Tom and Kevin said. It's just, this is just not a clear-cut situation at all.
Now, the de facto government has scheduled elections, a presidential election, in November. Tom, is that likely to solve this? Because we'll have an election and somebody will be elected and we can all recognize that person as the legitimate leader of Honduras?
Well, it's that election that really puts a deadline on this crisis. I mean, this really has to be resolved before that. What the State Department said yesterday is that at the current time, It cannot accept this election as legitimate. If nothing changes between now and November, this election will not be legitimate. If a government is elected in Honduras that is not recognized as legitimate by the United States and the other Latin American countries, this crisis will get a whole lot worse.
And why would the election not be seen as legitimate, possibly?
Because it'll be carried out by this de facto government. It's not because, I mean, Zelaya's party is actually competing in this election. So theoretically, all political forces will be represented. And Micheletti, the de facto president, says he'll invite in international observers to see that the election is fair. But nevertheless, the fact would remain that it's an election carried out and overseen by a government that whose own legitimacy is questionable.
It's been interesting to watch everyone try to figure out what to call this government. You know, there are those who call it the interim government and the de facto government. We wrestle with these things all the time.
Let's go back to the phones. We'll talk to Lance. He's calling us from Long Island in New York. Lance, you've been really patient. Thanks for holding on.
Oh, no problem at all. I want to thank you for taking my call. And Michael, I want to get your book because I agree with the title very much.
But good title.
I think it's still in print.
Oh, I hope so. I'd like to return to the subject of Afghanistan, if possible. I'm concerned with the stability in that country. If one has read Ahmed Rashid's latest book, The Senate of Chaos, we know that we've squandered a lot of resources and a lot of time there. But it's a country we must not abandon. We cannot allow it to be a safe haven for the Taliban or al-Qaeda or anybody else. So what I'm suggesting is you can't stabilize that country until we somehow eradicate or deal with the heroin problem there, because it's raising a lot of funds for our opponents. What I'm suggesting is, since we're willing to spend fortunes to pick up all the loose fissile material that we can grab hold of in the world, I'm suggesting we do the same thing with the heroin, that we buy the heroin from the farmers themselves. In the meantime, help them make the transition to new crops and protect them by helping set up some kind of a strategic Hamlet program. I hate to use that term because it brings back memories, but the bottom line is that country must be stabilized. We must protect the farmers, and by just eradicating the crops, we're condemning a lot of the farmers to death, and they'll be very angry with this one. We really need them on our side, but we need to protect them from the Taliban, and the only way we can do that is to get rid of that heroin crop. I think we're going to need all the morphine, too, to tell you the truth.
All right. Lance, thank you very much for your call. Any response from our panel?
I love it. Foreign policy by felony. it's a really interesting idea. I would, as a practical matter, I think it would just spur production.
Well, one of the alternatives to that idea is to, on the one hand, eradicate the opium, but on the other hand, compensate the farmers for the loss of their income, which would accomplish both objectives.
And there were some efforts to do that, but they haven't succeeded.
Let's talk a little about the economy around the world. We've got world finance chiefs meeting in London this weekend, and on what's called the G20 strategy meetings, the 20 largest economies in the world. And, while we've had a lot of gloom and doom about the economy, we all know, for the past year, there are some signs that things are getting better.
Well, unquestionably, but the issues these guys are grappling with, and this is really just ahead of the G20 summit, leaders that's supposed to take place in Pittsburgh at the end of the month, are some pretty critical questions going forward. Tim Geithner, Treasury Secretary, gave a briefing the other day in which he talked about his fears of repeating mistakes made in the past. One of the ones that's most often cited, for example, was that during the Great Depression, the government stopped spending, and you had basically a double-dip depression in 1937-38. And Geithner is very, very aware of these lessons. So he has to persuade his fellow ministers, and indeed Obama has to persuade the fellow leaders at the G20, to maintain the stimuluses they have in their economies, because there has been a movement, particularly in Europe, to say, okay, it's over and let's retreat.
Michael and I were at this briefing with Tim Geithner, and he said something that sort of caught my attention. He said the Germans are pushing for a exit strategy to get out of these stimulus programs, quote, as soon as possible. Geithner's version of that is not as soon as possible, but to stay with those programs as long as it's necessary. And I think that sort of difference of words, although subtle, really kind of characterizes the different viewpoints between the United States and at least the Germans right now, but to some extent the Europeans as a whole.
Of course, the economic histories of the two countries are so different. I mean, the searing experience, the defining experience for Germans was inflation. And for the Americans, I think it's really unemployment. And that might lead the two countries to come to different conclusions about what they want to do.
And they have since the beginning of this negotiation. The interesting thing here is that while we've seen improvements in France and Germany, and particularly China, the one very notable exception is the UK, which continues to be a mess, and where Gordon Brown has been the biggest proponent of stimulus after Obama. And this is causing him a lot of trouble. And he's been one of the leaders of this the G20 movement to kind of create new financial architecture around the world. And
all right. Well, let's talk to Kathy. She's calling us from Logan, Ohio. Kathy, hi. You're on the Diane Rehm Show.
Hi. Good morning. I'd please like to address this to the gentleman in regards to Cuba. I am a midlifer, master's candidate in political science, emphasis Cuba, been there three times. Knowing that the U.S. defines, we define ourselves as humanitarians, and the blockade has been so long, and knowing that the likes of, and I might not be exactly correct, but the U.S. poultry growers, rice growers, international chambers of commerce want to end this blockade. What is your experience and opinion in regards to that? And thank you. I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Thank you, Kathy.
Well, you know, Kathy uses the term blockade, which is actually the term the Cuban government uses, but it's really not a blockade by any stretch of the imagination. In fact, the United States is now the largest supplier of agricultural products to Cuba of any other country, and the fifth largest trading partner in general. Food products, agricultural products, are exempt from the trade sanctions, and medicine as well. So it's not really correct to say that there is a blockade. Now, there still are trade sanctions, you know, and I think that in that regard, U.S. policy is responsible for some of the economic, you know, stress that Cubans feel. But if you look back at 50 years, for many, many years, Cuba was getting billions of dollars in Soviet aid, far in excess of the cost of the U.S. trade sanctions, and still the economy wasn't able to perform well. So there's a lot of blame to go around with respect to Cuba.
Castro and Kim Jong-il, like... talent has used this as a real crutch. I mean, he said that this is to blame for everything. If you walk around, as we have, you know, central Havana, go to people's apartments and see what they have and they don't have, they'll say, sure, I can go to a doctor, I can go to a pharmacy, but there are no drugs. There's nothing there to get. And Castro would say this is all the fault of the United States, but the bigger picture here is that those things could come from other places.
Kathy, thanks for your call, and congratulations on going back to school. I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We have time for another caller. Let's go to Indiana, Pennsylvania. Hi, Jose.
Hi.
You're on the air.
Hello, Jose. And I'd like to talk about the Honduran crisis. And because I'm still surprised that the United States is still considering or having the same position regarding the return and trying to force the return of the President Zelaya into power. So I believe that by now the U.S. should know that this was a fully legal based event, even though I can also understand that the first impression of seeing, you know, a group of military capturing the president and sending to exile is that of a military coup d'etat. But, you know, the thing is that the military were following an order by the courts for his capture, and I must recognize as well that sending President Zelaya to exile to Costa Rica was also a violation of the Constitution, but not his capture itself, mm-hmm. and not his removal, which was prompted by his actions trying to reform his Constitution, which is forbidden in Article 239 of the Constitution itself.
All right, Jose, thanks so much for your call. Any response from our panel?
You know, the interesting thing about the situation in Honduras, and Kevin alluded to it earlier, is how it's not a classic coup. I mean, it goes to the heart of what's democracy. You've got three branches of government represented in Honduras: the courts, the legislature, and the president. This was clearly an action against the president, which is undemocratic. But as he said, it had the support of both the Congress and the court, which are the other two branches.
Angus of Alexandria, Virginia, has sent us an email about the release of the Lockerbie bomber. You know, there's been just a huge international outcry over Scotland's decision to let the Lockerbie bomber go back to Libya. And it's caused some problems for the government in Great Britain. Why? Kevin, tell us.
It's made Gordon Brown's government look like they're playing a very cute game. Clearly, the ultimate responsibility for releasing him rested with the Scottish government. But the Scottish government didn't do this. It's very unlikely that they did this in a vacuum without some sort of consultation with London. That's just the way it goes there. So Brown has basically said, well, we didn't tell them to do it, which is probably true. But what he's not saying is that there's a tremendous amount of influence there, and there's an increasing amount of public evidence that the government of Britain had been advocating for this, or had at least been saying that they would tolerate it.
Now, why would they want this to go forward, for this man to be allowed to go back to Libya? Michael?
Well, oil is usually the reason for these things. And certainly that has been...
A British company is standing to get a good deal.
Yes, one area of speculation. Bear in mind that it was the British government under Tony Blair back early-ish in the Bush administration that actually led the effort, the initiative to open talks with Gaddafi and to begin to resolve these issues. So clearly there is a lot of diplomatic impetus there in terms of the relations between the two countries.
Tom, just very briefly, will this have any impact on U.S. relations with Great Britain, with Scotland, or with Libya?
Well, there was a former Justice Department official, David Rivkin, who was in London this week and quoted by the British press as saying that this is going to damage U.S. relations with Britain for years to come. And, of course, the FBI director, Robert Mueller, was outraged by it. I think that the relationship will survive, however.
I want to thank all three of you for being with us this hour. Tom Gelton, Kevin Sullivan, and Michael Hirsch. Thanks for being with us.
Great to be with you.
Thank you.
I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. She hopes to be back next week. Thanks for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkert, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Andrew Chadwick. Dori Anisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.